Hello and welcome to the New Testament Setting Podcast. My name is Dr. Benjamin Browning, and as we get started, I would encourage you to like, share, and leave a review on this podcast. It helps the channel out. Also, you can purchase my book called Facing the Mob, Rome, the Crowd, and the New Testament. It really helps us out. Hello, in today's podcast, I will have the second half of my friend Nicholas Noyola's interview of me about civil unrest and mob violence in the New Testament and how we can better understand that. If you want to check out the entire interview in video form, you can check it out at his YouTube channel, which I will have a link to in the description. Or you can just listen to the first episode, which aired last time. All right, I hope you enjoy.
Okay, all right, so let's backtrack a little bit, because we've talked about one cause in Paul's case. So what are some other causes of civil unrest during this kind of New Testament period?
So in terms of causes, obviously what we see in Acts happening all the time is this kind of religious strife, anger over differences of opinion. You see this often take place in the ancient world, where there'll be fights between different like guilds. Mm-hmm. And you see that taking place in Ephesus, there in Acts. You see in Ephesus there being a big thing where the silversmiths guild gets angry.
Yeah.
Because their bottom line is being hurt.
Yeah.
By this spread of Christianity. Yeah. So that's a case where you actually do see in the ancient world, you see guilds or collegium is what they would typically be called. Mm-hmm. Basically these professional organizations, these kind of clubs.
Yeah.
They would often get angry at each other and they'd come at each other.
Yeah.
You'd see this happen a lot in the ancient world, not just with those collegium.
Yeah.
But also with theater actors. You'd see within theaters, you would see like, we have this actor we really like, and then we have this actor we really like. And then all of a sudden, things get heated, and a huge fight breaks out.
So hold on. Let me process that. All right. So in my head, you know, like, okay, you know, Johnny Depp, Amber Heard trial, we're just like, oh, you know, love to see Amber Heard just like get sued and lose a bunch of money. But there's no fights breaking out in the street. How do they end up getting like coming to blows over their favorite actors? Like, how does that even evolve?
You know, you say that like it's strange, but we do have an example in Latin America where a literal war broke out after a soccer match. So
okay.
It's not that strange for us. It's not like we're so different.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So that's, so it happens.
Yeah.
So what would happen there is you would have a lot of heavy loyalty behind a particular individual, particular actor, a particular group. And then often, it wouldn't just be connected with a particular actor. Sometimes you have connection to a particular city. Mm-hmm. For example, in Pompeii, there is an example of a fight taking place between in Pompeii at the theater, mm-hmm. between rival cities. Basically, a group from these two cities is together.
Yeah.
Pompeii and another city.
Yeah.
And they're all in the same theater, and then they just break out into a fight.
Yeah.
And what ends up happening, I think it's under the reign of Nero. He ends up basically saying, all right, you cannot have theater. You cannot host theatrical things for like 10 years.
Yeah.
That's your punishment for this mob that broke out into a street fight.
Gotcha. So the sport kind of brought them together, but they already hated each other, and being brought together by the sport created like the environment for them to also erupt into like fist fighting and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And so it's not that strange,
gotcha.
Which is why you do see Roman officials kind of putting a lid on certain theater things, because that's when everyone gets together, right? Yeah. They don't have, you know, nowadays people get angry and they're watching TV and they get angry about something and they yell at their TV. Back then there was no TV. You're at the theater.
Yeah.
You know, so, and you're very close to each other. So the theater, eventually the Coliseum, the Circus Maximus, which is where you have races taking place. Mm-hmm. These would all be places where you'd have riots and those types of things taking place. Sometimes connected with the performances, mm-hmm. sometimes it was connected with a different issue.
Yeah.
And they would end up there. So for example, you have one case with Augustus where there is a group of soldiers that think that another soldier they know got executed, and they get angry and they just start like making a mess in the theater. And Augustus, the only way he could keep them from just ransacking the whole place is to bring in and present that guy and say, hey, see, he's alive. He's not really dead.
Yeah.
So that's one common thing. Another common reason that you have mobs and fights and this kind of stuff happening is a lack of food. People would get very frustrated if you have a lack of food. You don't really see that pop up in the New Testament a mm-hmm. lot. But it is interesting because you have a case where Claudius, mm-hmm. who we do see shows up and is important, kind of intersects with the New Testament. He's reigning at a time where Paul's missionary journeys are taking place. You have an event where there's a famine in the city and a whole bunch of people like surround Claudius and Emperor Claudius, and they start throwing bread at him.
Yeah.
Which I'm thinking, if there's a famine, why are you throwing perfectly good bread? Yeah. But Claudius is so terrified, he has to like kind of like run to escape.
Yeah.
And he orders immediately that day for extra grain ships to go and ship in grain.
Yeah.
Because he's so terrified of this mob. Another example where this kind of intersects is that very same Claudius is going to end up banning Jews and basically casting Jews out of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And he's going to kick all the Jews out of Jerusalem. And the reason is, most likely, if we listen to Suetonius, is because there seems to be some civil unrest taking place in Rome. Mm-hmm. So he bans Jews from Rome. And it seems to be because there's some civil unrest taking place in Rome. And the Jewish community is the community that's really spearheading that.
Yeah.
Now, Suetonius says that this is connected to a guy named Crestus, mm-hmm. which scholars would say might be referring to Christ, mm-hmm. in which case we have a case of Jews getting angry at Christians.
Yeah.
If that's the case.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question on like Roman involvement. So I guess I kind of just have like this idea, and maybe this is just what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe this is just kind of like a westernized like bias or something like that. But I have this idea that, you know, like the politicians are never involved for religious reasons. Like if the politicians get involved, it's because they see some threat arising from religious people that could cause like turmoil for, you know, society as a whole. Now, are there ever any politicians who are like, no, I have a religious conviction and therefore I want to squash, you know, Judaism, or I want to squash Christianity? Or is it always like, no, there's more of like an economic or a political factor at work that really motivates them?
Yeah, I'd say that question, it kind of betrays a very modern American view or Western view of the intersection between religion and politics. Mm-hmm. See, in their mind, in the ancient mind, it is intimately connected.
Yeah.
There is no separation. Mm-hmm. Oh, there's a famine? You know, there's a good reason there might be a famine. Well, because we have not shown proper respect to the gods.
Okay, gotcha.
you are not showing proper respect. We're not making the right sacrifices. We're not obeying the correct omens. We are not following the correct religious rituals. So these things are all deeply connected.
Yeah.
That's not to say that the political officials were not cynical about it.
Yeah.
Because they most certainly were.
Yeah.
So we have to kind of understand the divide between the elite and the common people. So you see ancient authors writing about this is like, oh, the common people are really gullible.
Yeah.
They believe in a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So you'll have examples for mob violence of, oh, well, a lightning hit a statue of one of the emperors. Mm-hmm. And that was seen as a bad omen. Mm-hmm. So a mob, you know, a riot started as a result.
Yeah.
So you have these kinds of events happening.
Yeah.
And then being interpreted, you're like, oh, well, the birds flew in a certain way around Rome and the masses took it to mean X.
Yeah.
So they started to riot. So you see ancient writers talking about these omens. You see ancient writers talking about these things and talking about how basically the common people got all upset and then the official had to come in and calm them down.
Gotcha.
So it's hard to, was some of it just cynical kind of,
yeah,
I don't really believe this stuff, but I want to please the people. Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But it was seen as your responsibility as the emperor.
Yeah.
Is also to be the head of Roman religion.
Yeah.
And there are certain practices,
yeah,
that are mandated as a result of that. Yeah. And if you don't do that, then if you do not follow these certain rituals, your actions can be interpreted as angering the gods and then that causing a mob, that causing a riot.
Yeah, so we shouldn't just discount the fact, like these people were also religiously devoted. Like there's no question, the leaders and I guess the commoners. So like when I go to the gas station, I spend $80 and like, I'm just mad at Biden, you know, but I'm not thinking in my head, what did we do to offend Yahweh, you know, but for them, yeah, you know, these economic, political and religious things, these sentiments would have been felt, you know, commonly.
Right. Yeah. So the idea, you know, you look at the gas pump type thing, like we look at that and we're like, oh, this politician did X.
Yeah.
You know, but if you're in the ancient world, you may, you know, if there was a equivalent to the gas pump, you know, you go and you go to the market and you try to buy some food and they're like, we don't have any, you know, there's a good chance that you're like, who angered the gods?
Yeah. And then boom, that guy, or like the politician probably angered the gods.
Yeah, they anger their eyes, or maybe a particular group, right? So that's one reason the Jews,
yeah,
Claudius gets all of the blame for exiling the Jews, for kicking the Jews out of Rome, because it shows up in the New Testament. But he's not the only one that did that. You have examples of Tiberius doing the same thing. There's this whole big thing where people were angry. They felt like they were being punished because of impiety.
Yeah.
And one of his remedies was, okay, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that, and I'm gonna kick the Jews out. Yeah. All right. You know, because these are people who are not properly showing respect to the gods in Rome. Therefore, if I kick them out, that will help put the, to use a Jewish term, put the sin out of the camp. Now, that's obviously not how the Romans thought, but to get rid of these impious people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, again, it's hard to say how much of this on the Roman, on the official side was being cynical.
Yeah.
Because you had certain Roman Greek and Roman philosophers that thought, oh, the gods, all these myths about gods, it's just, you know, it's just the commoners, you know. But you also have to say there was a real understanding. There was a real idea between the link between how things run in the government and if proper respect is being shown to the gods, which is when Christians later on start refusing to make sacrifices.
Yeah.
It's seen as a source of, all right, well, if you're not making sacrifices, like
you're not
people
paying
might
your tax,
starve to
basically
death.
Like your religious tax is not being paid now.
Yeah, but also like when the rubber meets the road, they're like, that child over there starved to death because you didn't make the sacrifices to Zeus.
Yeah.
Or to Jupiter.
Yeah.
Or we lost two legions because you didn't make proper sacrifices.
Gosh.
Like the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. We pay $80 at the Pope because the fine is a bad Catholic. No, I'm just kidding. I just couldn't avoid it. All right. So
yeah, there you go. Like if every time we looked at it, and well, some Christians too, actually.
Yeah, no, bro, we got some old heads at our church who definitely would be still thinking that way. But I mean, not that it's wrong. I mean, I just think you got there's just a God. There's one God for us to
right.
Know,
worship. Yeah, I mean, yeah. We have a connection. I mean, it's not as foreign. Some of these things are very foreign to us. That aspect of equating the immorality of the leaders or the failure of the culture to pay proper respect has a direct connection to the politics.
Yeah.
I think that's something that many people today would maybe say, well, maybe we have more in common with the ancient world than we would give ourselves credit for.
Yeah, for sure. So, all right. So we got these causes. I think we talked a good bit about the causes and kind of help people to get like a vivid picture of like how you know some of these events would come about. Now, we talked a little bit about responses. So I want to revisit like some responses. So on the one hand, you said, okay, so it would have been seen as a negative response to kind of wave your hand at unrest. And the typical response was to kind of like maybe escalate how you were going to react. So with a warning and then maybe, you know, taking baby steps this way. Now, I want to ask you for just a clarification. So yes, okay, we want to say that it would have been seen in a negative light by just waving your hand. But is that to say that this is necessarily uncommon, or even though it was a negative response, it was still typical of the day?
Yeah, so... Yeah, and what I do in the book, because it's been a while since I wrote this thing, I talk about all of the different responses, and I give, and for every response, I give like ancient examples of where you would see this. So in terms of the responses and kind of the tools at Rome's disposal, you have, I give kind of a progression.
Yeah.
Of like kind of how did they handle it? What was the progression that they went through? And really what you would see is you had kind of soft responses and hard responses.
Okay.
And you have examples for both. So inaction, this kind of strategic inaction or this strategic neglect, inaction was a response that would be used. And, but it was usually indicative of, it was usually being presented not necessarily as, again, one of three ways. This guy's just a bad leader, so he didn't act. This guy used inaction to see if it would blow over, and eventually he had to act because it didn't work.
Yeah.
And then this guy did it, and it was fine, you know, no harm, no foul. You know, it was fine. The only example of that third one that I could find was Vespasian. And of course, he had a huge army that he had just used to great effect, right? So typically, it makes sense, right? If I have people getting a little rowdy, they're getting a little frustrated, all right, I'm not going to make a bad situation worse.
Yeah.
But then once they've started getting violent,
The
idea within the Roman world is you need to do something.
Yeah.
Once the threat of violence becomes pretty heavy, you need to do something. So the kind of escalation that I see, that I kind of talk about in the book, is I give multiple different approaches.
Yeah.
So you have inaction mm-hmm. would be one.
Yeah.
Then you have like just I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
Again, we've talked about that one a lot. Yeah. You have prevention. So what are the things I can do way ahead of time to prevent this kind of thing from happening?
Yeah.
So some of the mm-hmm. prevention that you would see is like we won't allow collegium or guilds to form.
Okay.
Right. Or we'll put a harsh limit on those collegium or those guilds.
Mm-hmm.
We'll kind of limit what can happen, where public gatherings yeah. can happen. We'll put guards at the theaters, those mm-hmm. types of things. That's prevention. Another method, kind of on the soft measures of, again, people tend to view Rome as like stab first and ask questions later.
Yeah.
But when we deal with civil unrest, that's just not how Rome operated.
Yeah.
You know, once they got kind of under soft measures, if they couldn't prevent it from happening, if inaction didn't work because it's pretty clear it's going to escalate,
yeah.
then we have a couple of softer measures they would use. Concessions. Sometimes you see even emperors. Augustus did this a lot where he said, look, y'all want this. Okay, I'll do this.
Yeah.
I won't do that. But I'll do this. You think that omens have been violated, so you want me to be declared dictator for life? I don't want to do that because my adoptive father got killed for that.
Yeah.
I won't do that. But you know what I will do? You think that the omens are a reason the grain is not flowing because of those things? I will put a commission in place
mm-hmm.
that I will oversee to make sure that the grain comes in.
Okay.
He gives partial concessions. We have gotcha. Examples of full concessions being given.
Okay.
We have examples of just a public persuasion. Like, let me go talk to the crowd. Let me try to persuade them to come down, to stop being so angry. Now that was the most common.
That was the most common response. The I'm going to go persuade this mob.
Yes.
Really? That I would think that's got to be so uncommon. Who wants to go persuade a mob?
Well, no, it's the most common. One great article to read on this is an article by a guy named Benjamin Kelly.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the Phoenix Journal, which is a Canadian history journal. He's a historian. And man, I cannot remember the exact name of the article, but Benjamin okay. Kelly did some really good work on this. And what he talked about was how the primary focus here, the primary method used was persuasion. Let me try to talk this crowd down.
Wow.
You see this time and time again. Not just there, you see it in the New Testament,
yeah.
right? What happens in Ephesus when the silversmiths start this big mob? Well, a group of local leaders come together and speak to the crowd and say, hey, guys, watch out,
mm-hmm.
you know, otherwise the Romans are going to find out.
Yeah.
It's like this implicit threat.
Yeah.
The Romans are going to find out and they're not going to be happy.
Yeah.
You know, there's this implicit. So they try to persuade.
Yeah.
Again, you see Paul trying to persuade in Jerusalem. So you see that even in the Bible. This use of persuasion. But in ancient Roman sources, you see Augustus do it. Like one of my favorite examples is it's recorded by Appian.
Mm-hmm.
It's during that period where the civil war after Caesar's death has happened, that civil war is still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Augustus and he's not Augustus yet, he's Octavian at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Octavian and Mark Antony are allies, and all of a sudden in the Roman Forum, there's a whole lot of anger about something, and what Augustus tries to do is he tries to go in and he tries to talk them down.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately start trying to kill him.
Yeah, that makes sense. Why would you want to go talk to them?
And then what happens, Antony sees that his political ally is in danger, so Antony comes with his soldiers and he tries to talk to the crowd. He sees how that's working. He says, guys, he tries to calm them down so he can work his way through, to which they don't listen. So then he, with his soldiers, basically charge through and basically cut their way through the crowd, go save Antony and have to, but what you see there is an escalation, right? Yeah. It's this idea that as a Roman elite, your rhetorical ability, your ability to prove yourself through rhetoric is highly valuable.
Yeah.
Rhetoric is so important. The idea that someone could come through and with their words dripping with honey could convince a violent mob to stand down. It's the pinnacle of political power.
Yeah.
And we do see examples where Augustus does it, where Mark Antony does it.
Yeah.
We see examples where emperors and governors alike do it.
Yeah.
And that's the idea of prevention. Excuse me. That's the idea of persuasion.
Yeah.
Now, there are a couple different types of persuasion. Giving a speech, writing a public decree. These are all ways that you have persuasion taking place. And
okay,
persuasion,
so,
go ahead.
No, no, I was just going to say, go ahead.
And if persuasion doesn't work, there's another method, utilization, that I have in there, that utilization is where you basically where a government official uses a mob to their advantage. Now that's usually seen as a sign of a weak leader. But it happens.
How would one go about using a mob to their event? Like, they started the riot?
Well, what you basically see is you see, hey, there's this group of political supporters, and they're angry about something, and you say, hey, you're angry.
Yeah, yeah.
Go get that guy.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
That could happen today. All right, moving on.
That's what we do when we watch the news. I mean, this is...
Yeah, I mean, the difference today is like...
January 6th plug, bro. This gives us an opportunity.
Yeah, I was wondering if you were going to go there. Yeah. So, I mean, that's an example of, you know, now, whether or not it ended up quite the way he expected, I don't want to get into the politics of it. He essentially says, hey, y'all are angry. Go make your voice heard, right?
That's one way to put it.
Yeah. Make your presence known.
Yeah.
Right. Now, you don't want to get into the politics of what happened after that.
Yeah.
But you have an example of mobilizing a crowd into action. Mm-hmm. And again, we see this today happen all the time. It's not always violent action.
Yeah, for sure.
So you see that happen even in the ancient world, utilization of a crowd.
Okay.
And then there were other methods.
So just as we're walking through these, right? So you got these preventative strategies. You know, first of all, waiting isn't really a strategy because everyone starts by waiting to see what's going to happen, and then you decide, okay, how are we going to move forward? So you might have some of these preventative strategies, and then you got some kinds of concessions, so either partial, full concessions using persuasion. Then you got some people who use a mob. I'm just surprised we haven't heard about squashing the mob yet. Like, or I guess we talked a little bit about it, but I was just assuming, like, okay, there's going to be three, and that's going to be like number three. But I guess, is that kind of atypical? Is that uncommon?
Yeah. So the stick was always something kind of in the Roman arsenal. But that's the thing, is they usually, it was further down. Yeah. That was like usually one of the last things that was used. In fact, when you see it used, when you see an official taking the stab first, ask questions later approach, that's usually a picture of them being an unstable and bad leader.
Okay, so.
So that's usually seen as being something, and I think that surprises a lot of people, that's seen as being a weakness. Because most people think of the Romans as being so cruel and so mean, and certainly their capacity for cruelty was unparalleled at the time.
Yeah.
However, what we have to really understand is it's hard to rule someone when they're dead, right?
Yeah.
And when I go in and I start stabbing and killing and doing all these things, property often gets damaged, right? Mm. So if I start a riot, and just start really kind of going at it, yeah. Well, what can happen is large numbers of people could trample each other. And things could be, buildings could be burned down. All kinds of things can happen. In fact, I'll give you an example. But before I give you that example, let me kind of go through basically what you have on the hard map. I'm skipping some of these, but you have another way of persuading is intimidation. Mm-hmm. And another way of prevention is like putting security in place. But then kind of the last big one here is suppression, the use of force, overwhelming force or limited force, right? So let me give you an example of how this can go wrong and why this was seen as being a dangerous thing. There's this one government official, a guy named Cumanus. He was a governor in Judea. So he's responsible for things happening in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. So he's a governor in Judea. And what Cumanus does is during one of the big festivals, I think it's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. During one of the big feasts there at the temple, Cumanus has this situation where he wants to maintain order. So he sends soldiers out in this area around the temple, right? So he sends these soldiers out in the area around the temple. Well, what ends up happening is one of the soldiers being maybe not super respectful of the Jewish rituals, does something he's not supposed to do. He kind of exposes himself. Let's put it that way.
What an idiot.
Yeah. And it creates this big disturbance, right? And so Cumanus kind of comes out figuring out what's going on, and he's got these soldiers around him kind of protecting him, right? So what we see right out is we see security. So that's prevention. That's an aspect of prevention. He's got security there because he knows that religious festivals in Jerusalem can get heated. So he's got security there, but then it fails. People start to get angry. They get rowdy. Cumanus comes out. He's surrounded by soldiers who are trying to protecting him. He's trying to see what's going on. And then all of a sudden, as soldiers start to, this crowd starts to push in on Cumanus, and Cumanus starts to get a little scared, like these guys are about to attack us. So he orders his troops to basically push back.
Yeah.
And what happens is swords start going. And all of a sudden people just flip out because these soldiers are stabbing. They're going after the crowd. And now all of a sudden, it's not just a riot. Now that kind of mob, that threatening mob has turned into a rout. And people just start running. And they trample each other. And they go into these narrow alleyways and they start trampling. And people start crushing people to death. And Cumanus gets a lot of flack for this.
Yeah.
Because according to Josephus, now, if we take his word for it, thousands of people died that day because the use of force precipitated this rout.
Yeah.
And we actually see both Cumanus and Pilate. We love to talk about Pontius Pilate because of his role at Jesus' trial, but both Cumanus and Pontius Pilate. So Cumanus was a ruler that governed Jerusalem maybe a decade or so after Pontius Pilate. Both of them end up getting removed from their position because of how they dealt with civil unrest.
Yeah.
Because they were seen as being too aggressive. In the case of Pilate, there's an issue with the Samaritans, and there's a whole kind of issue with the Samaritans. They get riled up against the Jews. The Jews kind of come against them, and basically Pontius Pilate basically uses force against them, and they send word to Rome, to the emperor, and say, "Hey, he was way too aggressive here."
Yeah.
Oh, and wow. The emperor was like, "Yeah, I agree with you," and he removed him from his office.
Yeah.
So we see examples where Roman officials, if they were too harsh,
yeah,
could be removed from power. And we see it time and time again, now if they've got enough political clout, maybe they can prevent that from happening. Yeah. That may be what happened with Pilate.
Yeah.
Earlier on in his reign, he seemed to have done some pretty rough stuff, like straight stabbed a whole bunch of people.
Yeah, got away with it.
And got away with it.
Yeah.
But then later on, he doesn't quite have the same amount of political cover, and he gets removed for being that aggressive. So there's a lot of things that kind of affect how an official might respond.
Yeah.
But it seems to be, as we look at Roman sources, is the accepted method was to go from softer, less aggressive measures to escalate, like prevention, persuasion, maybe concessions, but you got to be careful because you don't want to look weak. And then working your way up, and if they won't listen, going on to either limited or full suppression.
Now, so on the suppression thing, and then I don't know how much time you got left, but I want to get to some New Testament passages here. On the suppression thing, is there an act of suppression that was just kind of like really like respectable to many Romans? Like, okay, that was an act of suppression that we all thought needed to happen, and we were glad it did.
Yeah, when the crowd gets violent. When the crowd gets violent, that's pretty much the accepted thing that we can pretty much see across the board is when the crowd starts to get really violent and refuses to yield. That's when you really see when you tried to persuade them, you maybe offered concessions, they don't listen and they get violent. Then force is okay. But again, you have to be careful of who you're attacking. Right? Who is it that you're getting violent against? Because if you're getting violent against kind of lower class Jewish people who don't have a lot of clout, then maybe you can get away with being a little more violent.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
So we have an example in Alexandria where you have Flaccus, the governor of Alexandria. He kind of does some things against the Jews, and it creates this whole big thing. Tons of Jews are killed, and Flaccus gets in trouble. The main reason Flaccus gets in trouble is because Herod Agrippa was close personal friends with Caligula and advocated on their behalf. Otherwise, he probably wouldn't have gotten in as much trouble as he did.
Gotcha.
So the typical thing you see is if they get violent, then you can get violent back.
Yeah.
However, it also really depends on what's the political clout of the people.
Gotcha.
So I could give other examples, but I know you want to, we only have about 13 or 14 minutes left.
All right, let's talk about some New Testament passages that will bring in all of this information. We got a lot of good stuff in here so far. So bringing all this stuff together, let's talk about some New Testament passages. The one that I wanted to ask about, because I think this was the first time that it really kind of stood out to me, is the scenes in the Gospels where Jesus clears the temple, and John clears the temple twice, you know? How is he not squashed as a rebel on the spot? Because I imagine how I envision the scenario is that Jesus is basically inciting mob activity, and it's during, you know, a really highly attended event. And if I'm a Roman watching this, I'm thinking, okay, yeah, no, you are not going to come in here during this Jewish festival and act like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think a couple things. One, I think it's important to understand, like, at the temple itself, the Jewish leaders had primary authority there. Now, you did have Roman contingent nearby in a fortress nearby, but the Jewish leaders primarily had control there. And the Jewish leaders were very much concerned with maintaining the peace. And this is where the understanding of rebel violence and banditry is really important here. And the Jewish leaders really trying to prevent, it was their responsibility to keep the people in order as much as possible. They want to keep as much of a lid on everything as possible. And Jesus had a lot of clout with the crowds. So you have an example there of if they had come at Jesus and attacked him like that, then they openly say, the gospel writers openly say, they wanted to make a move against Jesus, but they were afraid of the crowd. So notice when they attack Jesus, they do it at night, away from the crowds. And they do the trial before the Sanhedrin at night. And they do it on home territory. And then when they take him to the governor, it seems like, you know, most people say, hey, the same people that said were singing Hosanna, Hosanna one day, were singing Crucify the next day. It's probably not the same people. It was very common, if I'm coming to bring a case against an individual, that when I brought that case against an individual, I would bring my entourage. And it was very common for me to have people who I showed patronage to, people who were kind of connected to me, to come with me to a court. And for me to try to get as many of my people in that room as possible, in that area as possible, and get them to shout as loud as possible. So it's not like modern courts where everyone's like, shh. You know, it's not like that. It was expected that particularly a noble elite would get as many of their supporters to kind of pack the house and yell as loud as they could. So that was really common. So just kind of going back to your question, I think that's an important aspect, is the crowds that were kind of filling the temple and the crowds that were all around Jerusalem were very much pro-Jesus. So when you have this attack on Jesus, it's done at night. That's why Judas is important, because Judas is able to tell them, where will Jesus be when he's not with his, when he's not around the crowds? Where is a place where you can get Jesus with only like 12 or so people around him? So that's why this is important. And there's another aspect. There's a certain amount of theater going on. When Jesus cleansed the temple, there's a history of prophets using physical illustrations. You see all the major prophets doing this. I mean, you have examples of prophets stripping naked, walking through the streets, you know, beating themselves, saying, this is what's going to happen to you, Israel, if you don't, you know, if you don't turn. You know, so you have these kinds of examples. So many Jews would have looked at what Jesus did and said, he's a prophet. This is what prophets do. They do this kind of stuff. So it wouldn't be as much of a slam dunk, possibly. Now, he definitely made people mad. He made the religious leaders mad. And they took note, but they were afraid of the crowds.
Gotcha.
So you see, that's why Judas is so important. And in fact, I go into this in the book, where you have, particularly in Mark, you have a passage where it says, and they didn't want to attack Jesus because they were afraid of the crowds. And then you see, and then Judas came to them and said, hey, I'll turn him over. And then after, it's what we call Mark and Sandwich, where you have Mark splits up two stories. He splits the story in half by putting another story in the middle. So you see, they say they wanted to get Jesus, but they were afraid of the crowds. Then Judas says, hey, I'll turn him over to you. And then they say, after that, they say, and then they decided they were going to attack him, you know, go after him. Well, the reason is because now Judas, being willing to tell them when Jesus would be away from the crowds, has basically mitigated the risk for them.
That makes sense.
So you have an example there where you have government officials, the religious leaders who had some official power in Jerusalem, being afraid of the crowds. So they had to come up with a way. So they didn't take action because they were afraid of the crowds temporarily. So that's inaction, right? And then once they saw their opportunity, they went for it. Yep. And they got it when he wasn't with the crowds.
Okay. So do you want to do one more passage before we finish?
Yeah, I think we got time for one more.
Okay. Yeah. Which ones come to your mind?
I would say a really good one to go with would be probably the trial before Pilate.
Okay.
So when we get Jesus in the trial before Pilate, often people will say, I don't understand why. I don't understand why Pilate would set this innocent man, to just allow this innocent man to die. But I think if we look at this within the context of civil unrest, it makes a little more sense. Mm-hmm. So at Jesus's trial, we need to understand that we have these religious leaders who do have a lot of political clout. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, about 5 to 10 years later, it's these kinds of leaders that are going to work against Pilate and that's going to get Pilate removed, right? Mm-hmm. Elite leaders in the area.
Yeah.
So, of course, he didn't know that at the time. But yeah. So you have these leaders who are surrounded by crowds, and they're really kind of pressing him. Hey, we want you to turn him over. We want you to do this. We want you to do this. And notice what Paul does. He goes through the motions, right? First thing he tries to do is he tries to persuade them. He tries to talk them down, right? Mm-hmm. I don't really see any fault with him, but I'll talk to him. Hey guys, he didn't really do anything. Like, it's not a big deal. And then what does he do next? They don't listen. So he says, all right, well, I'll just beat him up real good. Mm-hmm. And so he flogs him. He does this and he turns him over, and they're like, not good enough. Crucify him. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what did he do? First, he tried persuasion. Then he tried limited concessions. Mm-hmm. And then he tries to divert. He basically tries to pass the buck, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, wait a minute. Herod, he's actually Herod's jurisdiction. So he tries to pass the buck, right? Yeah. Again, this is his way of not having to answer, not having to deal with it. But that doesn't work. Okay. Then what does he do? The next step from that is he tries to say, oh, well, let me give you another concession. Let me give him the way out. Hey, you have this choice. Barabbas, who is obviously violent, somebody that you should definitely want to get rid of, or Jesus, right? They don't take the exit lane. So what do you see happening? You see him in this situation, trying to exhaust his options, trying to do his best. And then finally you get to the end. And you see two big things. You see one, you see a questioning of his loyalty. You know, anyone who is a friend of this man's not a friend of Caesar. Mm-hmm. But also you see, and Matthew's explicit about this. Luke is more implicit, but Matthew's explicit. Matthew says, and when he saw that they were about to riot, he turned Jesus over to be crucified. Matthew does not pull any punches. He makes it very clear that it was riot or crucify Jesus.
Yeah.
Those are your two options.
Yeah.
And we have to understand. Now, I'm not taking Pilate off the hook, right? Mm-hmm. What he did was morally wrong.
Yeah.
It was pragmatic.
Yeah.
But he basically went through the typical playbook of what we would expect. Mm-hmm. Now, some will say, why did he not just violently suppress these government officials? Again, we need to understand they are elites. They are very, very influential, and they have the ear of the emperor.
Yeah.
So if he just kills a high priest and a whole bunch of other elites, he's going to have to really explain himself.
Yeah.
So that gets to what I was talking about earlier of, it matters who you're attacking.
Yeah.
You know, who the people are matters. Mm-hmm. So when he thinks he's afraid they're going to riot, he's like, okay, you know what? This guy's life is not worth me having to suppress and stand in front of the emperor and explain to him why I allowed a minor revolt to take place in a very volatile area.
So in terms of him offering up this option between Barabbas and Jesus, is that common practice, or was this something that was just like on the spot thinking, hey, I gotta do something here?
Yeah, that's the struggle, because we don't see anywhere
that was
in any other documents that this was a common practice.
Gotcha.
But it's something that the gospel writers agree on, you know? So it is probably a local practice that was common, that wasn't written about a lot. But yeah, we don't have a lot of external, extra biblical evidence of this practice. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it'd be great if we did.
But all of them attest to the fact that this was something that took
place. Yeah, but it's pretty well attested, you know, among the gospel writers. It's pretty well attested among the gospel writers. Particularly in the synoptics, definitely. I'm trying to remember if John does it, but the synoptics, you know, pretty much agree on this happening and this being a thing. So, yeah, it's interesting that we don't see it anywhere else. But again, if this is a lesser known tradition,
yeah, then that makes sense.
You know, you don't see necessarily Josephus having the need to talk about, oh, by the way, this one day a year, you know, there was this one practice. You know, he's not writing about that. That's not super important for his argument.
Yeah. All right, Ben. Well, I mean, I think we got a lot done in there. Again, the book is Facing the Mob. You guys are going to be able to find the link in the description to this video. Ben, is there anything else you would like to tell people in terms of where they can find you and some things to look out for?
Yeah, I mean, I have a website. It's just ntsetting.com. So you could check me out at my website. Yeah. And the big thing is also I have a podcast called the New Testament Setting Podcast. You can look that up. You should be able to find that, the New Testament Setting Podcast. And I also have a YouTube channel called Biblically Correct. And so the big thing I'm trying to plug right now is the New Testament Setting Podcast and the book. Check out the book. Check out the podcast. Those are the big things right now.
Gotcha. All right. And I'll make sure to link all of that in the description. Also, you got any papers you got coming out soon?
Not coming out. I recently presented a paper at a regional ETS, and I hope to turn that into an article. Mm-hmm. And I have another article that I'm shopping around right now on this Galileo incident.
Okay.
So hopefully I'm able to get that published. But nothing that's kind of in the works right now. Right now, I'm just really pushing the book.
Gotcha, man. Well, you gotta come up with the paper on Sosthenes, dude.
Yes.
That's what we need. All right, Ben. I appreciate it, dude. I think the interview went really well, and hopefully look forward to having you back on soon.
Awesome. Sounds great.
All right. Talk to you later, man.
Thank you for listening to the New Testament Setting Podcast. I encourage you to share this with friends, to leave a review, and also to purchase my book, Facing the Mob: Rome, the Crowd, and the New Testament. It really helps the channel out.